Side 6, The Ruby Knight by David Eddings. Continuing on page 240. She stopped and looked at him critically.
I told you to keep your hands on that spear, she scolded him. Now go back to your room and get it.
He threw his hands helplessly in the air and turned around.
Run, Sparhawk, she shouted after him.
He caught up with them just as they entered the doorway that opened out onto the stairs leading down into the sunken room near the center of the castle. Count Gossick still sat hunched over his book in the flickering light of his guttering candle. His fire had burned down to embers, and the wind from the storm outside howled fitfully in the chimney.
You're going to ruin your eyes, my lord, Sophronia told him. Put aside the book. We have things to do.
He stared at her in astonishment.
I need to ask a favor of you, my lord.
A favor? Of course, madame.
Don't be too quick to agree, Count Gossick. Not until you know what I'm going to ask you. There's a room in the cellar of your house. I need to visit it with Sir Bavia here, and I'll need to have you accompany us. If we move quickly enough, I can cure Bavia and rid this house of its curse.
Gossick stared at Sparhawk, his face totally baffled.
I'd advise doing as she says, my lord, Sparhawk told him. You'll do it in the end anyway, and it's a lot less embarrassing if you just agree gracefully.
Is she like this often?
The Count asked, rising to his feet.
Frequently.
Time is passing, gentlemen, Sophronia said,
her foot tapping impatiently on the floor.
Come with me, then, the Count said, giving up.
He led them up the stairs and into the cobwebby corridor.
The entrance to the cellar is this way.
He pointed down a narrow side hall and then led the way again. He took a large iron key from his doublet and unlocked a narrow door.
We'll need light, he said.
Curic took a torch down from its ring and handed it to him. The Count lifted the torch and started down a long flight of narrow stone stairs. Okuda and Curic supported the somnolent Bavier to keep him from falling as they descended. At the foot of the stairs, the Count turned to his left.
One of my ancestors considered himself to be quite a connoisseur of fine wines, he said, pointing at dusky casks and bottles lying on their sides on wooden racks back in the dimness as they passed. I have little taste for wine myself, so I seldom come down here. It was only by chance that I happened to send Okuda down here one night, and he came upon that dreadful room.
This is not going to be very pleasant for you, my lord, Sophronia warned him. Perhaps you might want to wait outside the room.
No, madame, he said. If you can endure it, I can as well. It's only a room now. What happened in it is in the past.
It's the past which I intend to resurrect, my lord.
He looked at her sharply. Sophronia is an adept in the secrets, Sparhawk explained. She can do many things.
I have heard of such people, the Count admitted. But there are few Styrics in Pelosia, so I've never seen those arts performed.
You may not wish to, my lord, she warned him ominously. It's necessary for Bavia to see the full extent of your sister's perversions, for him to be cured of his obsession. Your presence as the owner of the house is necessary, but if you stand just outside the room, it will suffice.
No, madame. Witnessing what happened here may stiffen my resolve. If my sister cannot be restrained by confinement, I may find it necessary to take sterner measures.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
This is the door to the room, the Count said, producing another key.
He unlocked the door and opened it wide. The sickening stench of blood and decaying flesh washed out over them. By the flickering light of the torch, Sparhawk saw immediately why this chamber had inspired such horror. A rack stood in the center of the blood-stained floor, and cruel hooks jutted from the walls. He winced when he saw that many of the hooks had gobbets of blackened flesh clinging to them. On one wall hung the gruesome implements of the torturer's trade, knives, pincers, branding irons, and needle-sharp hooks. There were also thumbscrews and an iron boot as well as assorted whips.
This may take some time, Sophronia said, and we must complete the task before morning.
Curic, take the torch and hold it as high over your head as you can. Sparhawk, hold the spear in readiness. Something may try to interfere.
She took Bavier's arm and led him toward the rack.
All right, Bavier, she said to him. Wake up.
Xavier blinked and looked around in confusion. "What is this place?" he said. "You're here to watch, not to talk, Xavier," she told him crisply. She began to speak in Styric, her fingers moving rapidly in the air in front of her. Then she pointed at the torch to release the spell. At first, nothing seemed to happen. But then Sparhawk saw a faint movement near the brutal rack. The figure was dim and hazy at first, but then the torch flared up and he could see it more clearly. It was the form of a woman, and he recognized her face. She was the Pelosian woman he had seen emerging from the Styric house in Kyrillos. Her face was also the face of the succubus that had hovered over Xavier's bed earlier this night. She was naked, and her face was exultant. In one hand she held a long, cruel knife, in the other a hook. Gradually another figure began to appear, strapped down on the rack. The second figure appeared to be that of a surf girl, judging from her clothing. Her face was contorted into an expression of mindless terror, and she struggled futilely with her bonds. The woman with the knife approached the bound figure on the rack and with deliberate slowness began to cut her victim's clothing away. When the surf girl had been stripped, the Count's sister methodically began on her flesh, muttering all the while in an alien Styric dialect. The surf girl was screaming, and the look of cruel exultation on Lady Bellina's face locked into a hideous grin. Sparhawk saw with revulsion that her teeth had been filed to points. He looked away, unable to watch any longer. And he saw Xavier's face. The Arshan watched in horrified disbelief as Bellina gorged herself on the girl's flesh. When it was done, blood was running from the corners of Bellina's mouth, and her body was smeared with it. Then the images changed. This time Bellina's victim was a male, and he writhed on one of the hooks protruding from the wall, while Bellina slowly carved small chunks from his body and ate them with relish. One after another, the procession of victims continued. Xavier was sobbing now and trying to cover his eyes with his hands. "No," Sophronia said sharply, pulling his hands down. "You must see it all." On and on the horror went as victim after victim came under Bellina's knife. The worst were all the children. Sparhawk could not bear that. And then, after an eternity of blood and agony, it was over. Sophronia looked intently into Xavier's face. "Do you know who I am, Sir Knight?" she asked him. "Of course," he sobbed. "Please, Lady Sophronia," he begged. "No more, I pray you." "How about this man?" She pointed at Sparhawk. "Sir Sparhawk of the Pandion Order, my brother knight."
"And him?"
"Curic Sparhawk's squire."
"And this gentleman?"
"Count Gossick, owner of this unhappy house."
"And him?"
She pointed at Okuda. "He's the Count's servant, a good and honest man."
"Is it still your intention to release the Count's sister?"
"Release her? Are you mad? That fiend belongs in the deepest pit in hell."
"It's worked," Sophronia said to Sparhawk. "We won't have to kill him now." There was a great relief in her voice. Sparhawk cringed back from the implication in her matter-of-fact tone.
"Please, m'lady," Okuda said in a shaking voice, "can we go out of this horrible place now?"
"We are not finished yet. Now we come to the dangerous part. Curic, take the torch to the back of the room. Go with him, Sparhawk, and be ready for anything."
Shoulder to shoulder, the two slowly walked to the back of the chamber. And then, in the flickering torchlight, they saw the small stone idol set in a niche on the back wall. It was grotesquely misshapen, and had a hideous face.
"What is it?"
Sparhawk gasped.
"That is Azash,"
Sophronia replied.
"Does he actually look like that?"
"Approximately. There are some things about him that are too horrible for any sculptor to capture."
The air in front of the idol seemed to waver, and a tall skeletal figure in a hooded black robe suddenly appeared between the image of Azash and Sparhawk. The green glow coming out of the hood grew brighter and brighter.
"Don't look at its face," Sophronia warned them sharply. "Sparhawk,
Slide your left hand up the shaft of the spear until you're holding the blade. He vaguely understood, and when his hand reached the blade socket, he felt an enormous surge of power. The seeker shrieked and flinched back from him, and the glow from its face flickered and began to fade. Grimly, step by step, Sparhawk advanced on the hooded creature, holding the spear blade out in front of him like a knife. The seeker shrieked again, and then vanished. "Destroy the idol, Sparhawk," Sophronia commanded. Still holding the spear, he reached forward with one hand and took the idol from its niche. It seemed terribly heavy, and it was hot to the touch. He raised it overhead and dashed it to the floor, where it shattered into hundreds of pieces. From high up in the house came a shriek of unutterable despair.
"Done," Sophronia said.
"Your sister is powerless now, Count Gassak. The destruction of the image of her god has bereft her of all supernatural capabilities, and I think that were you to look at her, you'd find that she once again appears as she did before she entered the Styric house in Kyrillos."
"I will never be able to thank you enough, Lady Sophronia," he said with gratitude.
"Was that the same thing that's been following us?" Curic asked.
"Its image," Sophronia replied. "Azash summoned it when he realized that the idol was in danger."
"If it was only an image, then it wasn't really dangerous, was it?"
"Don't ever make that mistake, Curic. The images Azash summons are sometimes even more dangerous than the real things."
She looked around with distaste. "Let us leave this revolting place," she suggested. "Lock the door again, Count Gassak, for the time being. Later on it might be wise to wall up the entrance."
"I'll see to it," he promised.
They went back up the narrow stairs and returned to the vaulted room where they had found the Count. The others had already gathered there.
"What was all that awful screaming?" Talon asked. The boy's face was pale.
"My sister, I'm afraid," Count Gassak replied sadly.
Colton looked warily at Bavier. "Is it safe to talk about her in front of him?" he quietly asked Sparhawk. "He's all right now," Sparhawk answered, "and Lady Bellina has been stripped of her powers." "That's a relief. I wasn't sleeping too well under the same roof with her." He looked at Sophronia. "How did you manage it?" he asked. "Cure Bavier, I mean." "We found out how the lady was influencing others," she said. "There's a spell that temporarily counteracts that sort of thing. Then we went to a room in the cellar and completed the cure." She frowned. "There's still a problem, though," she said to the Count. "That minstrel's still out there. He's infected, and the servants you sent away probably are as well. They can infect others, and they could return with a large number of people. I cannot remain here to cure them all. Our quest is far, far too important for such delay."
"I will send for armed men," the Count declared. "I have enough resources for that. And I will seal up the gates of this castle. If necessary, I will kill my sister to prevent her escape."
"You may not have to go that far, my lord," Sparhawk told him, remembering something Sophronia had said in the cellar. "Let's go have a look at this tower."
"You have a plan, Sir Sparhawk?"
"Let's not get our hopes up until I see the tower." The Count led them out into the courtyard. The storm had largely passed. The lightning was flickering on the eastern horizon now, and the pounding rain had diminished to intermittent tatters that raked the shiny stones of the yard.
"It's that one, Sir Sparhawk,"
the Count said, pointing at the southeast corner of the castle. Sparhawk took a torch from beside the entryway, crossed the rainy courtyard, and began his examination of the tower. It was a squat, round structure, perhaps 20 feet high and 15 or so in diameter. A stone stairway wound halfway around the side of it to a solidly barred and chained door at the top. The windows were no more than narrow slits. There was a second door at the base of the tower, and it was unlocked. Sparhawk opened it and went inside. It appeared to be a storeroom. Boxes and bags were piled along the walls, and the room appeared dusty and unused. Unlike the tower, however, the room was not round but semicircular. Buttresses jutted out from the walls to hold up the stone floor of the chamber above. Sparhawk nodded with satisfaction and went back outside again. "What's behind that wall in this storeroom, my lord?" he asked the Count.
There's a wooden staircase that runs up from the kitchen, Sir Sparhawk. In times when the tower had to be defended, the cooks could take food and drink to the men up there. Okuda uses it now to feed my sister.
Do the servants you sent away know about the stairway?
Only the cooks knew, and they were among the ones Okuda killed.
Better and better. Is there a door at the top of those stairs?
No. Just a narrow slot to push the food through.
Good. The ladies misbehaved a bit, but I don't think any of us would want to starve her to death. He looked around at the others. Gentlemen, he said to them, we're going to learn a new trade.
I don't quite follow you, Sparhawk, Tinian admitted.
We're now going to be stonemasons. Kurek, do you know how to lay brick and stone?
Of course I do, Sparhawk, Kurek said disgustedly. You should know that.
Good. You'll be our foreman, then. Gentlemen, what I'm going to suggest may shock you, but I don't think we have any choice. He looked at Sophronia. If Bellina ever gets out of that tower, she's probably going to go looking for Zamox or the Seeker. Would they be able to restore her powers?
Yes, I'm sure they could.
We can't allow that. I don't want that cellar ever to be used that way again.
What are you proposing, Sir Sparhawk?
The Count asked. We're going to wall up that door at the top of those stairs, Sparhawk replied. Then we'll tear the stairway down and use the stones to wall in this door at the base of the tower as well. Then we'll conceal the door that leads from the kitchen to that stairway inside the tower. Akuda will still be able to feed her, but if the minstrel or those servants ever manage to get inside the castle, they'll never figure out how to get to that room up there. Lady Bellina will live out the rest of her life right where she is.
That's a rather horrible thing to suggest, Sparhawk, Tinian said.
Would you rather kill her? Sparhawk asked bluntly. Tinian's face blanched. That's it, then. We brick her up inside.
Bavier's smile was chill.
Perfect, Sparhawk, he said. Then he looked at the Count. Tell me, my lord, which of the structures inside your walls can you spare?
The Count gave him a puzzled look.
We're going to need building stone, Bavier explained. Quite a bit of it, I think. I want the wall across that door up there good and thick.
Chapter 16. They removed their armor and put on the plain workman's smocks that Okuda provided, and then they went to work. They knocked out a portion of the back wall of the stable, working under Kurek's direction. Okuda mixed a large tub of mortar, and they began to carry building stones up the curved stairway to the door at the top of the tower.
Before you begin, gentlemen, Sophronia said, I'll need to see her.
Are you sure of that? Carlton asked her. She might still be dangerous, you know.
That's what I have to find out. I'm positive that she's powerless, but it's best to be certain. And I can't do that unless I see her.
And I'd like to see her face one last time as well, Count Gossack added. I can't bear what she's become, but I did love her once.
They mounted the stairs, and Kurek pried the heavy chain away from the door with a steel bar. Then the Count took yet another key and unlocked the door. Bavier drew his sword.
Is that really necessary? Tinian asked him.
It may be, Bavier replied bleakly.
All right, my lord, Sophronia said to the Count. Open the door.
The Lady Bellina stood just inside. Her wildly contorted face was pouchy and her neck wrinkled. Her tangled hair was streaked with gray, and her naked body sagged in unlovely folds. Her eyes were totally insane, and she pulled back her lips from her pointed teeth in a snarl of hate.
Bellina,
the Count began sadly, but she hissed at him and lunged forward with her fingers extended like claws. Sophronia spoke a single word, pointing her finger, and Bellina reeled back as if she had been struck a heavy blow. She howled in frustration and tried to rush at them again, but suddenly stopped, clawing at the air in front of her as if at some wall that none of them could see.
Close it again, my lord, Sophronia instructed sadly. I've seen enough.
So have I,
the Count replied in a choked voice and with tear-filled eyes as he closed the door.
She's hopelessly mad now, isn't she?
Completely. Of course, she's been mad since she left that house in Kyrelos, but she's absolutely gone now. She's no longer a danger to anyone but herself.
Sophrenia's voice was filled with pity.
There are no mirrors in that room, are there?
No. Would that pose some threat?
Not really. But at least she'll be spared the sight of herself. That would be too cruel. She paused thoughtfully. There are some common weeds hereabouts, I've noticed. There's a way to extract their juices, and they have a calming effect. I'll talk with Acuda and give him instructions for putting them in her food. They won't cure her, but they'll make it less likely that she'll hurt herself. Lock the door, my lord. I'll go back inside while you gentlemen do what needs to be done. Let me know when you're finished. Flute and Talon trailed after her as she walked back toward the castle.
Hold it right there, young man, Curic said to his son.
Now what?
Talon said.
You stay here.
Curic, I don't know anything about bricklaying.
You don't have to know all that much to carry stones up those stairs.
You're not serious.
Curic reached for his belt, and Talon hurried over to the pile of squared-off stones at the back of the stable.
Good lad there, Ulith noted. He grasps reality almost immediately.
Bavier insisted on being in the forefront of their work. The young Cyrenic laid building stones almost in a frenzy.
Keep them level, Curic barked at him. This is a permanent structure, so let's make a workmanlike job of it.
In spite of himself, Sparhawk laughed.
Something amusing, my lord? Curic asked him coldly.
No, I just remembered something, that's all. You'll have to share it with us later.
Don't just stand there, Sparhawk. Help Talon carry stones.
The embrasure into which the door was set was quite thick, since this tower was a part of the castle's fortifications. They built one wall flush against the door as the Count's sister shrieked insanely inside and pounded wildly against the door that they were sealing. Then they began a second wall tightly against the first. It was mid-morning when Sparhawk went into the castle to tell Sophrenia that they had finished.
Good, she said.
The two of them went back out into the courtyard. The rain had ceased now, and the sky had begun to clear. Sparhawk looked upon that as a good omen. He led Sophrenia to the stair that half encircled the tower.
Very nice, gentlemen,
Sophrenia called up to the others who were putting the finishing touches on the wall they had constructed.
Now come down from there. I have one last thing to do.
They trooped down and the small woman went on up. She began to chant in Styric. When she released the spell, the fresh-built wall seemed to shimmer for a moment. Then the shimmering was gone. She came back down.
All right, she said. You can knock down the stairs now.
What did you do?
Calton asked curiously.
She smiled. Your work was much better than you might have thought, dear one, she told him. The wall you built is totally impregnable now. That minstrel or the servants can pound on it with sledges until they're old and gray without damaging it in the slightest.
Curic, who had gone back up the steps, leaned out and looked down at them.
The mortar's completely dry, he reported. That usually takes days.
Sophrenia pointed at the door at the base of the tower.
Let me know when you finish this one. It's a bit damp and chilly out there. I think I'll go back inside where it's warm.
The Count, who had been more saddened by the necessary entombment of his sister than he had readily admitted, accompanied her back inside while Curic instructed his makeshift work crew on how to proceed. It took them most of the rest of the day to knock down the stone stairway leading to the now walled-in upper door and to seal off the lower one. Then Sophrenia came out, repeated the spell, and went back into the castle. Sparhawk and the others adjourned to the kitchen, which was located in a wing of the castle abutting the tower. Curic considered the small door leading to the inside staircase.
Well? Sparhawk asked him. Don't rush me, Sparhawk. It's getting late, Curic. Do you want to do this?
Sparhawk closed his mouth and watched without saying a word as Talon slipped away. The boy looked tired, and Curic was a hard taskmaster. Sparhawk was like that on occasion.
Curic consulted with Acuda for a few moments, then looked at his mortar-spattered crew.
Time to learn a new trade, gentlemen, he said. You're now going to become carpenters.
We're going to build a china cabinet out from that door. The hinges will still work, and I can fashion a hidden latch. The door will be completely concealed. He thought a moment, cocking his head to listen to the muffled shrieks coming from above. I think I'll need some quilts, Akuda, he said thoughtfully. We'll nail them to the other side of the door to keep the noise from being too loud in here.
Good idea, Akuda agreed. With no other servants around, I'll be spending a fair amount of time in here. And that screaming might get on my nerves.
That's not the only reason we're doing it, but that's all right. Very well, gentlemen, let's get to work. Curic grinned. I'll make useful people out of you all yet, he said. When they were done, the china cabinet was a solid piece of work. Curic rather liberally laid a dark stain over it, then stepped back and viewed the new woodwork critically. Wax it a couple times after the stain dries, he said to Akuda, and then scuff it up a bit. You'd probably better scratch it in a few places as well and blow dust into the corners. Then load it with crockery. Nobody will ever know that it hasn't been here for a century or more.
That is a very good man you've got there, Sparhawk, Ulith noted. Would you consider selling him?
His wife would kill me, Sparhawk replied. Besides, we don't sell people in Alania.
We're not in Alania.
Why don't we go back to that main room?
Not just yet, Sir Knights, Curic said firmly. First you have to sweep the sawdust up from the floor and put the tools away.
Sparhawk sighed and went looking for a broom. After they had cleaned up the kitchen, they washed the mortar and sawdust off themselves, changed back into tunics and hose, and returned to the large room with the vaulted ceiling, where they found the Count and Sophronia deep in conversation, while Talon and Flute sat not far away. The boy appeared to be teaching the little girl how to play draughts.
You look much neater now, Sophronia told them approvingly. You were all really very messy out there in the courtyard.
You can't lay brick or stone without getting mud on you, Curic shrugged.
I seem to have picked up a blister, Colton mourned, looking at the palm of his hand.
It's the first honest work he's done since he was knighted, Curic said to the Count. With a little training, he might not make a bad carpenter. But the rest of them have a long way to go, I'm afraid.
How did you conceal the door in the kitchen? The Count asked him.
We built a china cabinet against it, my lord. Akuda's going to do a few things to make it look old, and then fill it with dishes. We padded the back of it to muffle the sound of your sister's screaming.
Is she still doing that?
The Count sighed.
It will not diminish as the years go by, my lord, Sophronia told him. I'm afraid she'll scream until the day she dies. When she stops, you'll know that it's over.
Akuda's fixing us something to eat, Sparhawk said to the Count. It's going to take him a while, so this might not be a bad time to have a look at the chronicle you've compiled.
Excellent idea, Sir Sparhawk, the Count said, rising from his chair. Will you excuse us, madame?
Of course.
Perhaps you might care to accompany us.
She laughed.
Ah, oh, no, my lord. I'd be of no use in a library.
Sophronia doesn't read, Sparhawk explained. It has something to do with her religion, I think.
No,
she disagreed.
It has to do with language, dear one. I don't want to get into the habit of thinking in Aline. It might interfere at some point when I need to think and speak very rapidly in Styric.
Xavier, Ulith, why don't you come with the Count and me, Sparhawk suggested. Between you, you might be able to fill in some details that will help him pinpoint the story we need.
They went back up the stairs and left the room. The three knights followed the Count through the dusty hallways of the castle until they reached a door in the west wing. The Count opened the door and led them into a dark room. He fumbled around on a large table for a moment, took up a candle, and went back into the hallway to light it from the torch burning outside. The room was not large, and it was crammed with books. They stood on shelves stretching from floor to ceiling and were piled in the corners.
You are well read, my lord, Xavier said to him.
It's what scholars do, Sir Xavier. The soil hereabouts is poor, except for growing trees, and the cultivation of trees is not a very stimulating activity for a civilized man.
He looked around fondly.
These are my friends, he said. I'll need their companionship now more than ever, I'm afraid. I won't be able to leave this house ever again. I'll have to stay here to guard my sister.
The insane don't usually live for very long, my lord, Ulith assured him. Once they go mad, they begin to neglect themselves. I had a cousin who lost her mind one winter. She was gone by spring.
It's a painful thing to hope for the death of a loved one, Sir Ulith. But God help me, I find that I do.
The Count put his hand on a foot-thick stack of unbound paper lying on his desk.
My life's work, gentlemen.
He seated himself.
To business, then. Exactly what are we looking for?
The grave of King Sarek of Thalesia, Ulith told him. He didn't reach the battlefield down in Lamarkan, so we assume he fell in some skirmish up here in Pelosia or in Deira, unless his ship was lost at sea. Sparhawk had never thought of that. The possibility that Beliom lay at the bottom of the Straits of Thalesia or the Sea of Palos chilled him.
Can you generalize a bit? The Count asked. Which side of the lake was the king's destination? I've broken my chronicle down by districts to give it some organization.
In all probability, King Sarek was bound for the east side, Davia replied. That's where the Thalesian army engaged the Zamox.
Are there any clues at all about where his ship landed?
Not any that I've ever heard, Ulith admitted. I've made a few guesses, but they could be off by 100 leagues or so.
Sarek might have sailed to some seaport along the north coast, but Thalesian ships don't always do that. We're reputed to be pirates in some quarters, and Sarek might have wanted to avoid the tiresome questions and just driven his prow up onto some deserted beach.
That makes it a little more difficult, Count Gossack said. If I knew where he'd landed, I'd know which districts he might have passed through. Does Thalesian tradition provide any description of the king?
Not in very much detail, Ulith replied. Only that he was about 7 feet tall.
That helps a bit. The common people probably wouldn't have known his name, but a man of that size would have been remembered.
He began to leaf through his manuscript.
Could he possibly have landed on the north coast of Deira? He asked.
It's possible, but unlikely, Ulith said. Relations between Deira and Thalesia were a bit strained in those days. Sarek probably wouldn't have put himself in a position to have been captured.
Let's begin up around the port of Apalia, then. The shortest route to the east side of Lake Rondera would run south from there.
He began to leaf through the pages in front of him. He frowned.
There doesn't seem to be anything useful here, he said. How large was the king's party?
Not very sizable, Ulith rumbled. Sarek left Emsat in a hurry, and he only took a few retainers with him.
All of the accounts I picked up in Apalia mention large bodies of Thalesian troops. Of course it could be, as you suggested, Sir Ulith. King Sarek might have landed on some lonely beach and bypassed Apalia entirely. Let's try the port of Nadera before we start combing beaches and isolated fishing villages.
He consulted a map and then turned to a place about halfway through the manuscript and began to skim through it.
I think we've got something, he exclaimed with a scholar's enthusiasm. A peasant up near Nadera told me about a Thalesian ship that slipped past the city during the night early in the campaign and sailed several leagues up the river before she landed. A number of warriors disembarked, and one of them stood head and shoulders above the rest. Was there anything unusual about Sarek's crown?
It had a large blue jewel on top of it, Ulith said, his face intent.
That was him, then, the Count said exultantly. The story makes particular mention of that jewel. They say that it was the size of a man's fist.
Sparhawk let out an explosive breath. At least Sarek's ship didn't sink at sea, he said with relief. The Count took a length of string and stretched it diagonally across the map. Then he dipped his pen into his inkwell and made a number of notes.
All right, then, he said crisply. Assuming King Sarek took the shortest course from Nadera to the battlefield, he'd have passed through the districts on this list. I've done research in all of them. We're getting closer, Sir Knights. We'll track down this king of yours yet.
He began to leaf through rapidly.
No mention of him here, he muttered half to himself, but there weren't any engagements in that district.
He read on, his lips pursed.
Here, he said, his face breaking into a smile of triumph.
a group of Thalesians rode through a village 20 leagues to the north of Lake Veni. Their leader was a very large man wearing a crown. We're narrowing it down.
Sparhawk found that he was actually holding his breath. He had been on many missions and quests in his life, but this searching out a trail through paper had a strange excitement to it. He began to understand how a man could devote his life to scholarship with absolute contentment.
And here it is, the Count said excitedly. We found him.
Where? Sparhawk demanded eagerly.
I'll read you the entire passage, the Count replied. You understand, of course, that I've cast the account in more gentlemanly language than that of the man who told it to me.
He smiled.
The language of peasants and serfs is colorful, but hardly suitable for a scholarly work.
He squinted at the page.
Oh, yes, now I remember. This fellow was a serf. His master told me that the fellow liked to tell stories. I found him breaking up clods with a mattock in a field near the east side of Lake Veni. This is what he told me. It was early in the campaign, and the Zaymoks under Otha had penetrated the eastern border of Lamarkand and were devastating the countryside as they marched. The western Elanian kings were rushing to meet them with all the forces they could muster, and large bodies of troops were crossing into Lamarkand from the west, but they were primarily farther south than Lake Veni. The troops coming down from the north were mostly Thalesians. Even before the Thalesian army landed, however, an advance party of them rode south past Lake Veni. Otha, as we all know, had sent out skirmishers and patrols well in advance of his main force. It was one of those patrols that intercepted the party of Thalesians mentioned above at a place called Giant's Mound.
Was the place named before or after the battle? Euleth asked.
It almost had to have been after, the Count replied. Pelosians don't erect burial mounds. That's a Thalesian custom, isn't it?
Right. And the word giant describes Sarek rather well, wouldn't you say?
Exactly my thought. There's more, though.
The Count continued to read.
The engagement between the Thalesians and the Zaymoks was short and very savage. The Zaymoks vastly outnumbered the small band of northern warriors and soon swarmed them under. Among the last to fall was the leader, a man of enormous proportions. One of his retainers, though sorely wounded, took something from his fallen leader's body and fled west toward the lake with it. There is no clear account of what it was that he took or what he did with it. The Zaymoks pursued the retainer hotly, and he died of his wounds on the shore of the lake. However, a column of Alcyone knights, men who had been returned to their mother house in Deira to recuperate from wounds received in the campaign in Rendor, happened by on their way to Lake Randera and exterminated the Zaymok patrol to the last man. They buried the faithful retainer and rode on, by purest chance missing the site of the original engagement. As it happened, a sizable force of Thalesians had been following the first party by no more than a day. When the local peasants informed them of what had transpired, they buried their countrymen and erected the mound over their graves. His second Thalesian force never reached Lake Randera since they were ambushed 2 days later, and all were slain.
And that explains why no one ever knew what had happened to Sarek, Euleth said. There was no one left alive to tell anybody about it.
This retainer, Xavier mused, might it have been the king's crown he took?
It's possible, Euleth conceded. More likely, though, it would have been his sword. Thalesians put great value on royal swords. It won't be hard to find out, Sparhawk said. We'll go to Giant's Mound and Tinian can raise Sarek's ghost. He'll be able to tell us what happened to his sword and his crown.
Here's something odd, the Count said. I remember that I almost didn't write it down because it happened after the battle. The serfs have been seeing a monstrously deformed shape in the marshes around Lake Veni for centuries now.
Some swamp creature, Xavier suggested. A bear, perhaps?
I think that serfs would recognize a bear, the Count said.
Maybe a moose, Euleth said. The first time I ever saw a moose, I couldn't believe anything could get that big. And a moose hasn't got the prettiest face in the world.
I remember that the serfs said that the thing walks on its hind legs.
Could it possibly be a troll?
Sparhawk asked. That one who was roaring outside our camp down by the lake?
Did the serfs describe it as shaggy and very tall? Yuluth asked.
It's shaggy, right enough. But they say it's squat, and its limbs are all twisted.
Yuluth frowned.
That doesn't sound like any troll I've ever heard about, except maybe...
His eyes suddenly went wide.
Gwerig! He shouted, snapping his fingers. It has to be Gwerig! That nails it down, Sparhawk. Gwerig's looking for Beliom, and he knows right where to look.
I think we'd better go back to Lake Venny, Sparhawk said, and just as fast as we can. I don't want Gwerig to find Beliom before I do. I definitely don't want to have to wrestle him for it.
Chapter 17.
I am eternally in your debt, my friends,
Gossick said to them in the castle courtyard the next morning as they were preparing to leave. And we are in yours as well, my lord, Sparhawk assured him. Without your aid, we'd have had no chance of finding what we seek.
Godspeed, then, Sir Sparhawk,
Gossick said, shaking the big Pandion's hand warmly. Sparhawk led the way out of the courtyard and back down the narrow track to the foot of the crag.
I wonder what's going to happen to him, Talon said rather sadly as they rode along.
He has no choice, Sophronia said. He has to stay there until his sister dies. She's no longer a danger, but she still has to be guarded and cared for.
I'm afraid the rest of his life is going to be very lonely, Colton sighed.
He has his books and chronicles, Sparhawk disagreed. That's all the company a scholar really needs.
Yuluth was muttering under his breath.
What's the trouble?
Tinian asked him.
I should have known that the troll at Lake Venny was there for some specific reason, Yuluth replied. I could have saved us some time if I'd investigated.
Would you have recognized Gwerig if you'd seen him?
Yuluth nodded.
He's dwarfed, and there aren't very many dwarfed trolls about. She-trolls usually eat deformed cubs as soon as they're born.
That's a brutal practice.
Trolls aren't famous for their gentle dispositions. They don't even get along with each other most of the time.
The sun was very bright that morning, and the birds sang in the bushes near the deserted village in the center of the field below Count Gossick's castle. Talon turned aside to ride into the village.
There won't be anything in there to steal, Curic called after him.
Just curious is all, Talon called back. I'll catch up with you in a couple of minutes.
Do you want me to go get him? Bayret asked.
Let him look around, Sparhawk said. He'll complain all day if we don't.
Then Talon came galloping out of the village. His face was deathly pale and his eyes were wild. When he reached them, he tumbled from his horse and lay on the ground, retching and unable to speak.
We'd better go have a look, Sparhawk said to Colton. The rest of you wait here.
The two knights rode warily into the deserted village with their lances at the ready.
He went this way, Colton said quietly, pointing to the tracks of Talon's horse in the muddy street with the tip of his lance.
Sparhawk nodded, and they followed the tracks to a house that was somewhat larger than the others in the village. The two dismounted, drew their swords, and entered. The rooms inside were dusty and devoid of any furniture.
Nothing at all in here, Colton said.
I wonder what frightened him so much.
Sparhawk opened the door to a room at the back of the house and looked inside.
You'd better go get Sophronia, he said bleakly.
What is it?
A child. It's not alive, and it's been dead for a long time.
Are you sure?
Look for yourself.
Colton looked into the room and made a gagging sound.
Are you sure you want her to see that?
He asked.
We need to know what happened.
I'll go get her, then.
The two went back outside. Colton remounted and rode out to where the others waited while Sparhawk stood near the door of the house. A few minutes later, the blonde knight returned with Sophronia.
I told her to leave Flute with Curic, Colton said. We wouldn't want her to see what's in there.
No, Sparhawk replied somberly. Little mother, he apologized to Sophronia. This will not be pleasant.
Few things are, she said resolutely.
They took her inside the house to that back room.
She took one quick look and then turned aside.
Colton, she said, go dig a grave.
I don't have a shovel, he objected.
Then use your hands.
Her tone was intense, almost savage.
Yes, Sophrania.
He seemed awed by her uncharacteristic vehemence. He left the house quickly.
Oh, poor thing,
Sophrania mourned, hovering over the desiccated little body. The body of the child was withered and dry. Its skin was gray and its sunken eyes were open.
Belina again?
Sparhawk asked. His voice seemed loud even to himself.
No, she replied. This is the work of the Seeker. This is how it feeds.
Here, she pointed at dry puncture marks on the child's body.
And here,
here,
and here.
This is where the Seeker fed. It draws out the body's fluids and leaves only a dry husk.
Not any more, Sparhawk said, his fist closing about the haft of Aldrea's spear. The next time we meet, it dies.
Can you afford to do that, dear one?
I can't afford not to. I'll avenge this child against the Seeker or Azash or even against the gates of Hell itself.
You're angry, Sparhawk.
Yes, you could say that.
It was stupid and served no purpose, but Sparhawk suddenly tore his sword from its scabbard and destroyed an unoffending wall with it. It didn't accomplish anything, but it made him feel a little better. The others came silently down into the village and to the open grave Colton had grubbed out of the earth with his bare hands. Sophrania came out of the house with the dry body of the child in her arms. Flute came forward with a light linen cloth, and the two carefully wrapped the dead child in it. Then they deposited it in the rude grave.
Xavier, Sophrania said, would you...
This is an Aline child, and you are the most devout among these knights.
I am unworthy.
Xavier was weeping openly.
Who is worthy, dear one? She said. Will you send this unknown child into the darkness alone?
Xavier stared at her and then fell to his knees beside the grave and began to recite the ancient prayer for the dead of the Aline Church. Rather peculiarly, Flute came up beside the kneeling Arshan. Her fingers gently wove through his curly blue-black hair in a strangely comforting way. For some reason, Sparhawk began to feel that the strange little girl might be far, far older than any of them realized. Then she raised her pipes. The hymn was an ancient one, almost at the core of the Aline faith, but there was a minor styric overtone to it. Briefly, in the sound of the little girl's song, Sparhawk began to perceive some unbelievable possibilities. When the burial was complete, they mounted and rode on. They were all very quiet for the rest of that day, and they stopped for the night at the campsite beside the small lake where they had encountered the wandering minstrel. The man was gone.
I was afraid of that, Sparhawk said. It was too much to hope that he'd still be here.
Maybe we'll catch up with him farther south, Colton suggested. That horse of his wasn't in very good shape.
What can we do about him, even if we do catch him? Finian said. You weren't planning to kill him, were you?
Only as a last resort, Colton replied. Now that Sophrania knows how Belina influenced him, she could probably cure him.
Your confidence is very nice, Colton, she said, but it might be misplaced.
Will the spell she put on him ever wear off? Xavier asked.
To some degree. He'll grow less desperate as time goes on, but he'll never be entirely free of it. It might even make him write better poetry, though. The important thing is that he'll grow less and less infectious. Unless he meets a fair number of people in the next week or so, he won't be much of a danger to the Count, and neither will those servants.
That's something, at least, the young Cyrenic said. He frowned slightly.
Since I was already infected, why did that creature come to me that night? Wasn't that just a waste of her time?
Xavier seemed still strongly shaken by the funeral service for the dead child.
It was for reinforcement, Xavier, she told him. You were agitated, but you wouldn't have gone so far as to attack your companions. She had to make sure you'd go to any lengths to free her from that tower.
As they were setting up their night's camp, something occurred to Sparhawk. He went over to where Sophronia sat by the fire with her teacup in her hands. "Sophronia," he said, "what's Azash up to? Why is he suddenly going out of his way to corrupt Aline's? He's never done that before, has he?"
"Do you remember what the ghost of King Aldreas said to you that night in the crypt?" she said. "That the time had come for Beliom to reemerge?"
"Yes.
Azash knows that, too, and he's growing desperate. I'd guess that he's found that his Zamoks aren't reliable. They follow orders, but they're not very bright. They've been digging up that battlefield for centuries now, and they just keep plowing over the same ground. We've found out more about Beliom's location in the past few weeks than they've found out in the past 500 years.
We were lucky."
"That's not entirely true, Sparhawk. I know that I tease you sometimes about Aline logic, but that was precisely what's gotten us so close to Beliom. A Zamok is incapable of logic. That's Azash's weakness. A Zamok doesn't think because he doesn't have to. Azash does all his thinking for him. That's why Azash so desperately needs Aline converts. He doesn't need their adoration. He needs their minds. He has Zamoks all over the Western Kingdoms gathering old stories in the same way that we did. I think he believes that one of them will stumble over the right story, and that then his Aline converts will be able to piece together the meaning of it."
"That's the long way around, isn't it?"
"Azash has time. He's not pressed by the same sense of urgency that we are."
Later that night, Sparhawk was standing watch some distance away from the fire, looking out over the small lake that glittered in the moonlight. Again, the howls of wolves echoed back in the dismal woods, but now for some reason the sound did not seem so ominous. The ghastly spirit that had haunted this forest was locked away forever, and the wolves were only wolves now and not harbingers of evil. The Seeker, of course, was an entirely different matter. Grimly, Sparhawk promised himself that the next time they encountered it, he would bury the spear of Aldreas in the hideous creature.
"Sparhawk, where are you?"
It was Talon. He spoke quietly and stood near the fire, peering out into the darkness. "Over here." The boy came toward him, putting his feet down carefully to avoid hidden obstructions on the ground. "What's the problem?" Sparhawk asked him.
"I couldn't sleep. I thought you might like some company."
"I appreciate that, Talon. Standing watch is a lonely business."
"I'm certainly glad to be away from that castle," Talon said. "I've never been so scared in my life."
"I was a little nervous myself," Sparhawk admitted.
"Do you know something? There were all sorts of very nice things in Gossick's castle, and I didn't once think of stealing any of them. Isn't that odd?"
"Maybe you're growing up."
"I've known some very old thieves," Talon disagreed.
Then he sighed disconsolately. "Why so mournful, Talon?"
"I wouldn't tell just anyone this, Sparhawk. But it's not as much fun as it used to be. Now that I know I can take just about anything I want from almost anybody, the thrill has sort of gone out of it."
"Maybe you should look for another line of work."
"What else am I suited for?"
"I'll give it some thought and let you know what I come up with." Talon laughed suddenly. "What's so funny?" Sparhawk asked him.
"I might have just a little trouble getting references," the boy replied, still laughing. "My customers didn't usually know they were doing business with me."
Sparhawk grinned. "It could be a problem," he agreed. "We'll work something out." The boy sighed again.
"It's almost over, isn't it, Sparhawk? We know where that king's buried now. All we have left to do is go dig up his crown. And then we'll go back to Simera. You'll go to the palace and I'll go back to the streets."
"I don't think so," Sparhawk said. "Maybe we can come up with an alternative to the streets."
"Maybe. But the minute it gets tedious, I'll just run away again. I'm going to miss all this, you know. There have been a few times when I was so scared I almost wet myself, but there have been good times, too. Those are the ones I'll remember."
"At least we gave you something." Sparhawk put his hand on the boy's shoulder. "Go back to bed, Talon. We'll be getting up early tomorrow."
"Whatever you say, Sparhawk."
They set out at dawn, riding carefully along the rutted road to avoid injury to the horses,
They passed the woodcutter's village without stopping and pressed on.
"How far do you make it?" Calton asked about mid-morning.
3, maybe 4 more days. 5 more at the most," Sparhawk replied.
"Once we get out of this forest, the roads improve and we'll make better time.
Then all we have to do is find Giant's Mound.
That shouldn't be much of a problem.
From what Gossick said, the local peasantry uses it as a landmark.
We'll ask around.
Then we get to start digging.
It's not really the sort of thing you want to have somebody do for you.
Do you remember what Sophrania said at Alstrom's castle back in Lammerkand? Colton said seriously.
The business about Beliom's reemergence ringing through the whole world?
Vaguely, Sparhawk replied.
Then the minute we dig it up, Azash is going to know about it, and the road back to Simra could be lined on both sides with Zamox.
It could be a very nervous trip.
Ulith was riding directly behind them.
Not really, he disagreed. Sparhawk's already got the rings. I can teach him a few words in the language of the trolls. Once he's got Beliom in his hands, there's almost nothing he won't be able to do. He'll be able to bowl over whole regiments of Zamox.
Is it really that powerful?
Colton, you have no idea. If even half the stories are true, Beliom can do almost anything. Sparhawk could probably stop the sun with it if he wanted to.
Sparhawk looked back over his shoulder at Ulith.
Do you have to know troll language to use Beliom? He asked.
I'm not really sure, Ulith replied. But they say that it's infused with the power of the troll gods.
They might not respond to words spoken in Aline or Styric.
The next time I talk with a troll god, I'll ask him.
They camped in the forest again that night. After supper, Sparhawk walked away from the fire to do some thinking. Xavier quietly joined him.
Will we stop in Veni when we reach it? The Cyrenic asked.
More than likely, Sparhawk replied. I doubt that we'd be able to get much farther tomorrow.
Good. I'll need to find a church.
Oh?
I've been contaminated by evil. I need to pray for a while.
It wasn't really your fault, Xavier. It could have happened to any one of us.
But it was me, Sparhawk, Xavier sighed. The witch probably sought me out because she knew that I'd be susceptible.
Nonsense, Xavier. You're the most devout man I've ever met.
No, Xavier disagreed sadly. I know my own weaknesses. I am powerfully attracted to members of the fair sex.
You're young, my friend. What you feel is only natural.
It subsides in time,
or so I'm told.
Do you still feel those urges? I'd hope that by the time I reached your age, they would no longer trouble me.
It doesn't work exactly that way, Xavier. I've known some very old men whose heads could still be turned by a pretty face. It's part of being human, I suppose.
If God didn't want us to feel that way, he wouldn't permit it.
Patriarch Dolmant explained it to me once when I was having a problem with it. I'm not sure I entirely believed him, but it made me feel a little less guilty.
Xavier chuckled.
You, Sparhawk. This is a side of you I hadn't seen. I thought you were totally consumed with your sense of duty.
Not entirely, Xavier. I still have a little time for other thoughts as well. I'm sorry you didn't get the chance to meet Lelius.
Lelius?
A renderous woman. I lived with her while I was in exile.
Sparhawk!
Xavier gasped.
It was part of a necessary disguise.
But surely you didn't...
Xavier left it hanging. Sparhawk was sure that the young man was blushing furiously, but the darkness concealed it.
Oh, yes, he assured his friend. Lelius would have left me otherwise. She's a woman of strong appetites. I needed her to help conceal my real identity, so I more or less had to try to keep her happy.
I'm shocked at you, Sparhawk, truly shocked.
The Pandions are a more pragmatic order than the Cyrenic Xavier. We do what has to be done in order to get the job finished. Don't worry, my friend. Your soul hasn't been damaged. At least not very much.
I still need to spend some time in a church.
Why? God is everywhere, isn't he?
Of course.
Talk with him here, then.
It wouldn't be quite the same.
Whatever makes you feel right, I suppose.
They set out again at first light. The road now tended downward, for they were coming down out of the low range of forested hills. On occasion, when rounding a curve or cresting a hill, they could see Lake Venny sparkling in the spring sun off in the distance. By mid-afternoon, they reached the fork in the road. The main road was much better than had been the one leading down from Gossick, and they reached the north gate of Venny just before the sunset filled the western sky with its fire. Once again, they rode through the narrow streets, with the overhanging houses casting a premature darkness, and arrived back at the inn where they had previously stayed. The innkeeper, a jovial fat Pelosian, welcomed them, and led them upstairs to the second floor where the sleeping rooms were located.
"Well, my lords," he said, "how was your sojourn in those accursed woods?"
"Quite successful, neighbor," Sparhawk replied, "and I think you can begin to pass the word around that Gossick's no longer a place to be feared. We found out what was causing the problem and took care of it."
"Thanks be to God for the Knights of the Church," the innkeeper cried enthusiastically. "The stories that have been going around have been very bad for business here in Venny. People have been choosing other routes because they didn't want to go into those woods."
"It's all taken care of now," Sparhawk assured him.
"Was it some kind of monster?"
"In a manner of speaking," Colton replied.
"Did you kill it?"
"We entombed it." Colton shrugged, starting to remove his armor.
"Good for you, my lord."
"Oh, by the way," Sparhawk said, "we need to find a place called Giant's Mound. Do you by any chance happen to know where we should start looking?"
"I think it's on the east side of the lake," the innkeeper replied. "There are some villages down there. They're back a ways from the lake shore because of all those peat bogs."
He laughed.
"The villages won't be hard to find. The peasants down there burn peat in their stoves. It puts out quite a bit of smoke, so about all you have to do is follow your noses."
"What are you planning to offer for supper tonight?" Colton asked eagerly. "Is that all you ever think about?" Sparhawk said. "It's been a long trip, Sparhawk. I need some real food. You gentlemen are good companions, but your cooking leaves a bit to be desired."
"I've had a haunch of beef turning on the spit since this morning, my lord," the innkeeper said. "It should be well done by now."
Colton smiled beatifically. True to his word, Bavier spent the night in a nearby church and rejoined them in the morning. Sparhawk chose not to question him concerning the state of his soul. They rode out of Venny and took the road south along the lake. They made much better time than they had when they had made the trip to the city. On that occasion, Colton, Bavier, and Tinian had been recovering from their encounter with the monstrous thing that had emerged from the burial mound at the north end of Lake Rondera. But now, they were wholly restored and able to ride at a gallop. It was late afternoon when Keurig pulled up beside Sparhawk. "I just caught a trace of peat smoke in the air," he reported. "There's a village of some kind around here." "Colton," Sparhawk called.
"Yes?"
"There's a village nearby. Keurig and I are going to go have a look. Set up camp and build a good fire. It might be after dark before the two of us get back, and we'll need something to guide us in."
"I know what to do, Sparhawk."
"All right, do it then." Sparhawk and his squire turned aside from the road and galloped across an open field toward a low band of trees a mile or so to the east. The smell of burning peat grew stronger, a strangely homelike smell. Sparhawk leaned back in his saddle, feeling strangely at ease.
"Don't get too confident," Keurig warned. "The smoke does strange things to their heads. Peat burners are not always very reliable. In some ways, they're worse than lemurks."
"Where did you get all this information, Keurig?"
"There are ways, Sparhawk. The church and the nobility get their information in dispatches and reports. The commons go to the heart of things."
"I'll remember that." "There's the village."
"You'd better let me do most of the talking when we get there," Keurig advised. "No matter how hard you try, you don't sound much like a commoner."
It was a low village. Shallow, wide houses built of gray fieldstone and roofed with thatch lined both sides of the single street. A thick-bodied peasant sat on a stool in an open-sided shed milking a brown cow.
"Hello there, friend," Keurig called to him, slipping down from his horse.
The peasant turned and stared at him in slack-lipped stupidity.
"Do you happen to know about a place called Giant's Mound?" Keurig asked him.
The fellow continued to gape at him without answering.
Then a lean man with squinting eyes came out of a nearby house. "Won't do you no good to talk to him," he said. "He got kicked in the head by a horse when he was young, and he hadn't been right since."
"Oh," Keurig said. "Sorry to hear about that.
Maybe you could help us. We're looking for a place called Giant's Mound. You're not planning to go there at night, are you?"
"No, we thought we'd wait until daylight."
"That's a little better, but not much. It's haunted, you know."
"No, I didn't know that."
"Whereabouts is it?" "You see that lane as runs off toward the southeast?"
The lean man pointed. Keurig nodded.
"Come sun up, follow that. It runs right past the mound, 4, maybe 5 mile from here."
"Have you ever seen anybody poking around it, maybe somebody digging?"
"Never heard tell of nothing like that. People as has good sense don't poke around haunted places."
"We've heard that you've got a troll in this area."
"What's a troll?"
"Ugly brute all covered with hair. This one is pretty badly deformed."
"Oh, that thing. It's got a lair someplace out in the bogs. It only comes out at night. It wanders up and down the lake shore. It makes awful noises for a while and then pounds on the ground with its front paws, as if it was real mad about something. I seen it a couple times myself when I was cutting peat. I'd stay away from it if it was me. It seems like it's got an awful bad temper."
"Sounds like good advice to me."
"Ever see any styrics hereabouts?" "No, they don't come around here. People in this district don't hold with heathens much." "You sure are full of questions, friend."
Keurig shrugged.
"Best way to learn things is to ask questions," he said easily. "Well, go ask somebody else. I got work to do."
The fellow's expression had turned unfriendly. He scowled at the stupid fellow in the shed.
"You done with the milkin' yet?"
he demanded. The slack-lipped idiot shook his head apprehensively.
"Well, get at it. You don't get no supper till you're done."
"Thanks for your time, friend," Keurig said, remounting. The lean man grunted and went back into the house.
"Useful," Sparhawk said as they rode out of the village in the ruddy light of the setting sun.
"At least there aren't any Zamoks around."
"I'm not so sure, Sparhawk," Keurig disagreed. "I don't think that fellow was the best source of information in the world. He doesn't seem to take too much interest in what's going on around him. Besides, Zamoks aren't the only ones we have to worry about. That seeker thing could set just about anybody on us. And we've also got to keep an eye out for that troll. If Sophrenia is right about that jewel's making its reemergence known, the troll would be one of the first ones to know, wouldn't he?"
"I don't know. We'll have to ask her."
"I think we'd better assume that he will. If we dig the crown up, we should more or less expect a visit from him."
"That's a cheery thought. At least we found out where the mound is located. Let's go see if we can find Colton's camp before it gets dark." Colton had set up for the night in a copse of beech trees a mile or so back from the lake, and he had built a large fire at the edge of the grove. He was standing beside it when Sparhawk and Keurig rode in.
"Well?"
he asked.
"We got directions to the mound," Sparhawk replied, climbing down from his saddle.
"It's not very far. Let's go talk with Tinian." The heavily armored Alcyone was standing by the fire talking with Yuleth. Sparhawk related the information Keurig had obtained from the villager, then looked at Tinian.
"How are you feeling?"
he asked directly.
"I'm fine."
"Why? Am I looking unwell?"
"Not really. I was just wondering if you felt up to necromancy again. The last time took quite a bit out of you, as I recall."
"I'm up to it, Sparhawk," Tinian assured him, "provided you don't want me to raise whole regiments."
"No, just one. We need to talk with King Sarek before we dig him up. He'll probably know what happened to his crown, and I want to be sure he's not going to object to being taken back to Thalesia. I don't want an angry ghost trailing along behind us."
"Truly," Tinian agreed fervently. They rose before dawn the next morning, and waited impatiently for the first sign of daylight along the horizon to the east. When it came, they were ready,
and they set out across the still dark fields.
I think we should have waited for more light, Sparhawk, Colton grumbled. We're likely to run around in circles out here.
We're going east, Colton. That's where the sun comes up. All we have to do is ride toward the lightest part of the sky.
Colton muttered something to himself.
I didn't quite catch that, Sparhawk said. I wasn't talking to you.
Oh, sorry. The pale pre-dawn light gradually increased, and Sparhawk looked around to get his bearings.
That's the village over there, he said, pointing. The lane we want to follow is on the far side of it.
Let's not rush too much, Sophronia cautioned, drawing her white robe about Flute. I want the sun to be up when we reach the mound. The talk of haunting may be just a local superstition, but let's not take any chances.
Sparhawk curbed his impatience with some difficulty. They rode through the silent village at a walk, and entered the lane the surly villager had pointed out. Sparhawk nudged Farron into a trot.
It's not all that fast, Sophronia, he said in response to her disapproving expression. The sun will be well up by the time we get there.
The lane was lined on both sides by low fieldstone walls, and, like all country lanes, it wandered. Farmers, by and large, took little interest in straight lines and usually followed the path of least resistance. Sparhawk's impatience grew greater with each passing mile.
There it is, Ulith said finally, pointing ahead. I've seen hundreds like it in Thalesia.
Let's wait until the sun gets a little higher, Tinian said, squinting at the sunrise. I don't want any shadows around when I do this.
Where's the king likely to be buried?
In the center, Ulith replied, with his feet pointed toward the west. His retainers will be in ranks on either side of him.
It helps to know that.
Let's ride around it, Sparhawk said. I want to see if anybody's been digging, and I definitely want to make sure that nobody's around. This is the sort of thing we want lots of privacy for.
They cantered around the mound. It was quite high, and it was perhaps 100 feet long and 20 wide. Its sides were covered with grass, and it was smoothly symmetrical. There were no signs of any excavations.
I'm going up on top, Keurig said when they returned to the road. That's the highest point around here. If anybody's in the area, I should be able to see them from up there.
You would actually walk on a grave? Bavier's tone was shocked.
We're all going to be walking on it in a little while, Bavier, Tinian said. I'll need to be fairly close to where King Sarek's buried to raise his ghost.
Keurig clambered up the side of the mound and stood atop it, peering around.
I don't see anybody, he called down. But there are some trees off to the south. It might not hurt to have a look before we get started.
Sparhawk ground his teeth together, but he had to admit to himself that his squire was probably right.
Keurig slid down the grassy side of the mound and remounted.
Sophronia, Sparhawk said, why don't you stay here with the children?
No, Sparhawk, she refused. If there are people hiding in those trees, we don't want them to know that we have any particular interest in this mound.
Good point, he agreed. Let's just ride on down to those trees as if we intended to keep going south.
They moved out, following the winding country lane across the fields.
Sparhawk, Sophronia said quietly as they approached the edge of the trees,
there are people in those woods, and they aren't friendly.
How many?
A dozen at least.
Hold back a little bit with Talon and Flute, he told her.
All right, gentlemen, he said to the others. You know what to do.
But before they could enter the woods, a group of poorly armed peasants dashed out from under the trees. They had that vacant look that immediately identified them. Sparhawk lowered his lance and charged with his companions thundering along at either side of him. The fight did not last for very long. The peasants were unskilled with their weapons, and they were on foot. It was all over in a few minutes.
Nicely done, Sir Knights,
a chillingly metallic voice said sardonically from the shadows back under the trees. Then the robed and hooded seeker rode out into the morning sunlight.
But no matter, it continued. I know where you are now.
Sparhawk handed his lance to Keurig and drew Aldrea's spear out from under his saddle skirt.
And we know where you are as well, Seeker, he
he said in an ominously quiet voice. "Do not be foolish, Sir Sparhawk," it hissed. "Thou art no match for me. Why don't we try it and find out?" The hooded figure's hidden face began to glow green. Then the light flickered and faded. "Thou hast the rings," it hissed, seeming much less sure of itself now. "I thought you already knew that." Then Sophronia joined them. "It has been quite some time, Sophronia," the thing said in its hissing voice.
"Not nearly long enough to suit me," she replied coldly.
"I will spare thy life if thou wilt fall down and worship me."
"No, Azash, never. I will remain faithful to my goddess." Sparhawk stared at her and then at the seeker in astonishment.
"Thinkest thou that Afrael canst protect thee if I decide that thy life serves no further purpose?"
"You've decided that before without much noticeable effect. I will still serve Afrael."
"As thou seest fit, Sophronia."
Sparhawk moved Farron forward at a walk, sliding his ringed hand up the shaft of the spear until it rested on the metal shank. Once again he felt that enormous surge of power.
"The game is almost played out, and its conclusion is foregone. We will meet once again, Sophronia, and for the last time."
Then the hooded creature wheeled its horse and fled from Sparhawk's menacing approach. Part 3. The Troll Cave. Chapter 18.
"Was that really Azash?" Colton asked in awe.
"His voice," Sophronia replied.
"Does he really talk like that? All that hissing?"
"Not really. The Seeker's mouth parts distort things."
"I gather that you've met him before," Tinian said, shifting the shoulder plates of his bulky armor.
"Once," she said shortly, "a very long time ago."
Sparhawk got the distinct impression that she didn't really want to talk about it.
"We may as well go back to the mound," she added.
"Let's get what we came for and leave before the Seeker comes back with reinforcements." They turned their horses and rode back along the winding lane. The sun had fully risen by now, but Sparhawk nonetheless felt cold. The encounter with the Elder God, even though by proxy, had chilled his blood and seemed to have even dulled the sun. When they reached the mound, Tinian took his coil of rope and laboriously led the way up the steep side. Again he laid out the peculiar pattern on the ground.
"Are you sure you won't raise one of the king's retainers by mistake?" Colton asked him.
Tinian shook his head.
"I'll call Sarek by name."
He began the incantation, and concluded it by clapping his hands sharply together. At first nothing seemed to happen, and then the ghost of the long-dead King Sarek began to emerge from the mound. His chainmail armor was archaic and showed huge rents in it from sword and axe. His shield had been battered, and his ancient sword was nicked and scarred. He was enormous, but he wore no crown.
"Who art thou?"
the ghost demanded in a hollow voice.
"I am Tinian, your majesty, an Alcyone knight from Deira."
King Sarek stared sternly at him with hollow eyes.
"This is unseemly, Sir Tinian. Return me at once to the place where I sleep, lest I grow wroth."
"Pray forgive me, your majesty," Tinian apologized. "We would not have disturbed thy rest but for a matter of desperate urgency."
"Nothing hath sufficient urgency to concern the dead."
Sparhawk stepped forward.
"My name is Sparhawk, your majesty," he said.
"A Pandion, judging from thine armor."
"Yes, your majesty. The Queen of Elania is gravely ill, and only Beliom can heal her. We have come to entreat thee to permit us to use the jewel to restore her health. We will return it to thy grave when we have completed our task."
"Return it or keep it, Sir Sparhawk," the ghost said indifferently. "Thou shalt not find it in my grave, however."
Sparhawk felt as if he had been struck a sharp blow to the pit of the stomach.
"This Queen of Elania,
What malady hath she so grave that only Beliom can heal it?
There was only the faintest hint of curiosity in the ghost's voice.
She was poisoned, Your Majesty, by those who would seize her throne.
Sarek's expression, which had been blankly indifferent, suddenly became angry.
A treasonous act, Sir Sparhawk,
he said harshly.
Knowest thou the perpetrators?
I do.
And hast thou punished them?
Not as yet, Your Majesty.
They still have their heads? Have the Pandions become weaklings over the centuries?
We thought it best to return the Queen to health, Your Majesty, so that she might have the pleasure of pronouncing their doom upon them.
Sarek seemed to consider that.
It is fitting,
he approved finally.
Very well then, Sir Sparhawk. I will aid thee. Despair not that Beliom is not in the place where I lie, for I can direct thee to the place where it lies hidden. When I fell upon this field, my kinsman, the Earl of Hayde, seized up my crown and fled with it to keep it out of the hands of our foes. Hard was he pressed and gravely wounded. He reached the shores of yon lake ere he died, and he hath sworn to me in the house of the dead that with his dying breath he cast the crown into the murky waters, and that our foes found it not. Seek ye therefore in that lake, for doubtless Beliom still lies there.
Thank you, Your Majesty,
Sparhawk replied with profound gratitude. Then Uleth pushed forward.
I am Uleth of Thalesia, he declared, and I claim distant kinship with thee, my king. It is unseemly that thy final resting place be in foreign soil. As God gives me strength, I vow to thee that with thy permission I will return thy bones to our homeland and lay thee to rest in the royal sepulchre at Emsat.
Sarek regarded the braided Genidian with some approval.
Let it be so, then, my kinsman, for in truth my sleep hath been unquiet in this rude place.
Sleep here but for a short while longer, my king, for as soon as our task is completed, I will return here and take thee home.
There were tears in Uleth's ice-blue eyes.
Let him rest, Tinian, he said. His final journey will be long.
Tinian nodded and let King Sarek sink back into the earth.
That's it then, isn't it? Colton said eagerly. We ride to Lake Venny and go swimming.
It's easier than digging, Curic told him. All we have to worry about is the Seeker and that troll. He frowned slightly.
Sir Uleth, he said, if Gwerig knows exactly where Beliom is, why hasn't he retrieved it in all these years?
The way I understand it, Gwerig can't swim, Uleth replied. His body's too twisted. We'll probably still have to fight him, though. As soon as we bring Beliom out of the lake, he'll attack us. Sparhawk looked toward the west, where the light from the newly risen sun sparkled on the waters of the lake. The tall summer green grass of the fields near the mound moved in long waves in the fitful morning breeze, and the fields were bounded near the lake by the grayish sedge and marsh grass that covered the peat bogs.
We'll worry about Gwerig when we see him, he said. Let's go have a closer look at this lake.
They all slid down the grassy side of the mound and climbed into their saddles.
Beliom shouldn't be too far out from shore, Uleth said as they rode toward the lake. Crowns are made of gold, and gold's heavy. A dying man couldn't throw something like that very far.
He scratched at his chin.
I've looked for things underwater before, he said. You have to be very methodical about it. Just floundering around doesn't accomplish very much.
When we get there, show us how it's done, Sparhawk replied.
Right. Let's ride due west until we come to the lake. If the Earl of Hayde was dying, he wouldn't have taken any side trips.
They rode on. Sparhawk's elation was overshadowed with some anxiety. There was no way to know how long it would be before the Seeker returned with a horde of numb-faced men at its back, and he knew that he and his friends could not wear armor while they probed the depths of the lake. They would be defenseless. Not only that, as soon as the spirit of Azash saw them in the lake, he would know exactly what they were doing. And, for that matter, so would Gwerig.
The light breeze was still blowing as they rode west, and puffy white clouds marched at a stately pace across the deep blue sky. "There's a grove of cedar trees up ahead," Keurig said, pointing to a low, dark green patch of vegetation a quarter of a mile away. "We're going to need to build a raft when we get to the lake. Come along, Beirut. Let's go start chopping." He led his string of pack horses toward the grove with the novice close behind him. Sparhawk and his friends reached the lake about mid-morning and stood looking out over the water rippling in the breeze. "That's going to make looking for something on the bottom very difficult," Colton said, pointing toward the murky, peat-stained depths. "Any notion of where the Earl of Hayde might have come out on the lake shore?" Sparhawk asked Euleth. "Count Garsick's story said that some Alcyone knights came along and buried him," the Genidian replied. "They were in a hurry, so they probably wouldn't have moved his body very far from where he fell. Let's look around for a grave." "After 500 years, Colton said skeptically, "there won't be much to mark it, Euleth." "I think you're wrong, Colton," Tinian disagreed. "Deirans build cairns over graves when they bury somebody. The earth might flatten out over a grave, but rocks are a bit more permanent." "All right," Sparhawk said. "Let's spread out and start looking for a pile of rocks." It was Talon who found the grave, a low mound of brown-stained stones partially covered by muddy silt that had accumulated over centuries of high water. Tinian marked it by sinking the butt of his pennon-tipped lance into the mud at the foot of the grave. "Shall we get started?" Colton asked. "Let's wait for Keurig and Beirut," Sparhawk said. "The lake bottom's a little too soupy for wading. We're going to need that raft." It was perhaps a half-hour later when the squire and the novice joined them. The pack horses were laboriously pulling a dozen cedar logs behind them. It was shortly after noon when they finished lashing the logs together with ropes to form a crude raft. The knights had discarded their armor and worked in loincloths, sweating in the hot sun. "You're getting sunburned," Colton told the pale-skinned Euleth. "I always do," Euleth replied. "The Lasians don't tan very well." He straightened as he finished tying the last knot in the rope that held one end of the raft together. "Well, let's launch it and see if it floats," he suggested. They pushed the raft down the slippery mud beach into the water. Euleth looked at it critically. "I wouldn't want to make a sea voyage on that thing," he said, "but it's good enough for our purposes here. Beirut, go over to that willow thicket and cut yourself a couple of saplings." The novice nodded and returned a few minutes later with two long springy wands. Euleth went to the grave and picked up two stones somewhat larger than his fist. He hefted them a couple of times, one in each hand, then tossed one to Sparhawk. "What do you think?" he asked. "Does that feel to be about the same weight as a gold crown?" "How would I know?" Sparhawk asked. "I've never worn a crown." "Guess, Sparhawk. The day's wearing on and the mosquitoes are going to come out before long." "All right, that's probably about the weight of a crown, give or take a few pounds." "That's what I thought." "All right, Beirut, take your saplings and pull the raft out into the lake. We're going to mark the area we want to search." End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.